This talk is offered by Ordinary Mind Zendo. Ordinary Mind was founded by Barry Magid, Dharma heir of Charlotte Joko Beck, and is dedicated to her vision of a psychologically minded Zen practice adapted to the needs of American students practicing in the context of their everyday lives. Our public programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
This is from Dogen Shobo Genzo, the Teisho called Kokyo, the ancient mirror. That which all the Buddhas and patriarchs transmit to each other is the ancient mirror. The ancient mirror and the Buddhas are one body. Outside the mirror, there are no Buddhas. And outside the Buddhas, there is no mirror. The seer and the seen, the reflector and the reflected are one. Practice and enlightenment are one. Everyone can become the ancient mirror and can perceive the ancient mirror. It is the truth in all things. The action of the ancient mirror is totally actualized in all things and in all changing phenomena. All things are actualized at the same time. The past is actualized, the present is actualized, Buddhas are actualized, patriarchs are actualized. Well, this is a long and convoluted teisho that Dogen gives here around the image of the ancient mirror, and he's going to find his way to the mirror in the Six Patriarchs poem and finally to the story of Nangaku and Basho. Basho is said to be polishing a tile in order to become a Buddha. But let's just begin with this metaphor of the ancient mirror. How do we understand that? Well, an ordinary mirror is one in which an object is reflected, but the reflection is an appearance. It may be distorted, it may be dull, but in any case, it's just an image, just an appearance, and the real thing is the object out in the world. The ancient mirror, you could say, is the opposite of that. The ancient mirror shows the true nature of things, and what's in the mirror, in a sense, is truer than how we ordinarily perceive the object itself. So we could say that whatever you put in front of the ancient mirror, its true nature is revealed. Its Buddha nature is revealed. Now, we could imagine kind of Freudian psychological mirror that, when you stand in front of it, all your, dirty secret fantasies are revealed in the mirror, as if that was your true self, right? But this mirror doesn't reveal what you're hiding and what you're ashamed of. It reveals who you essentially are in your perfection. And that perfection is your impermanence, your emptiness, your interconnection with all things. This is what Buddhas see, this is what patriarchs transmit. And in using this image, Dogen is going to try to convey to you a certain perspective on the nature of practice and zazen. Because inevitably our ordinary sense of practice is that we do it in order to achieve something, to become something, to make something happen. And the image of polishing a mirror is one in which our ordinary sense of practice is shown as one of kinds of endless, meticulous, day in, day out attempts at perfection, of removing dust, trying to get clearer and clearer. And so Dogen wants us to say, how would all this look from the perspective of enlightenment? Rather than the perspective of delusion and trying to achieve enlightenment, if you are already enlightened, how would your sitting look to you? How would you experience zazen? Would you keep sitting? Or would you sort of stop and say, well, I've got it, so long, guys. Right? The perspective of post-enlightenment practice is one in which our sitting actualizes, which is sort of a funny word, but is simply an expression of the true nature that's in the ancient mirror. It's the functioning of that true nature. It's what we do if we most clearly see who and what we are. Now, Dogen uses the story of Huinen, the sixth patriarch, and the poem he presents to the teacher as a way of trying to distinguish these two perspectives. This is Dogen's version of the sixth patriarch's poem. Bodhi, wisdom, is essentially not like a tree, nor is it like a bright mirror. Originally, not one thing exists. So where can the dust alight? So the poem is supposed to present an enlightened perspective on practice, one that goes against the image of mirror polishing that the head monk had presented. Mirror polishing, the removal of dust, is what our ordinary practice is like. Joko always talked about labeling thoughts as polishing the mirror, as a necessary kind of practice for people. And what labeling thoughts do? Basically, if your experience of your thought is that it's a contamination, an intrusion, if you're trying to sit with a quiet, clear, calm mind, but you've got all these goddamn thoughts going through your head, well, what labeling does is change your perspective on your thought. you label a thought by saying, thinking, I wish I had more of that butternut squash soup. And by labeling it, your attention is supposed to come away from the soup and onto the process of thinking, which is just thinking, 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 thinking. And the thoughts themselves are ephemeral, are empty. They come and they go. They're not something like the soup you want to get a hold of or get rid of. You can just leave them alone because they are just thoughts. We don't get hooked by the content. We rediscover their empty, impermanent nature. So in a sense, we switch perspective from a deluded to an enlightened perspective, one thought at a time. Right. That was her way of talking about what we do and labeling. But the Six Patriarchs poem tries to present that perspective as available all at once, immediately. And Dogen's comment on it is very interesting and very important. He says, in the phrase, not like a bright mirror, we find the true essence, and we should clarify the main point of this expression. It is that when the mirror is clear, everything is clear. The clear mirror reflects true form, and when everything is reflected, nothing remains. Furthermore, when there is no single defilement in the mirror, there is none anywhere in the world. We must learn this. The world is not a world of defilement. It is nothing other than the ancient mirror. I think this is a beautifully radical statement. The world is not a world of defilement. Our practice is not a practice of purification. We have to realize how totally that goes against the grain of so much of what gets called religious practice. The very essence of religious practice almost everywhere, including in Buddhism, involves the separating out of the pure from the impure. So much of what it meant to be a monk was to separate yourself from defilement, separate yourself from a world of attachment. Think how much in so many traditions, including Buddhist traditions, monks are celibate because sexuality is a defilement. Contact with women is a defilement. Attachment to family is something that has to be severed because that is a defilement. Home leaving becomes the essence of separation into a world of purity. It's very ingrained into the ascetic ideal that the world is a defilement and that we need to separate ourselves and purify ourselves. So Dogen is trying to offer a radically different picture of what we're doing in practice. Even in our meal chants, we say, may we exist like a lotus at home in the muddy water. Right? Other versions of that chant say, may we be like a lotus, the one pure thing in a world of dirty water. Right? There's a way in which we attempt to be the pure thing in a muddy world. But from this perspective, the world is not a world of defilement that we separate ourselves from. And, you know, I even went so far as to change a couple of lines in the meal chant where we say, for if to enjoy our life, we take this food, and thus we enjoy this food with everyone. I know I've, many other places over many years, been, you know, chanting where we act as if the meal is, you know, purely medicinal. You know, we take this food out of the grim necessity to keep ourselves alive in order to practice and attain the way, right? Well, enjoyment is not a defilement of our mind or our practice. Our happiness is not an obstacle or a defilement. The old Greek Stoic Zeno said that happiness is a sign of flourishing in human beings, the way flowers are a sign of flourishing in plants. So that our practice should culminate in our flourishing, our flowering, our happiness. Now the whole issue of polishing is one that it has ingrained in it this notion of purification, keeping the dust from alighting on the mirror. The alternative is to see the dust as empty, no defilement. The other very common metaphor that we encounter in this practice is not so much that the world is a defilement that we have to separate ourselves from. That's one version. But the other version is that our mind itself, our ego, is the problem, and it must be smashed in some way. That that the conceptual mind is like a cloudy mirror, that it distorts reality, that our very thinking, our very way of being in the world is something that is so thoroughly diluted that we must, one way or another, kill the self, smash the ego, right? Break through something, right? That metaphor is enormously pervasive and comes in a lot of different versions, not just in this practice. I came across another manifestation of that way of thinking. This was actually something that Jimbo showed me. It's from a memoir of the actor Peter Coyote, who before he became a movie star was very involved in the counterculture scene in San Francisco in the 60s and was part of the Diggers, the Mime Troupe and those folks. And I came across this section where he talked about getting to know Gary Snyder and telling Snyder about his earlier life there. So this is Peter saying, one day we, me and Gary, were discussing the notion of the mad and tortured artist and the ways in which even contemporary audiences tend to measure the sincerity of young artists by the degree of self-destruction they're willing to wreak upon themselves. I had been good friends with Janis Joplin and guitarist Mike Bloomfield, both of whom had died of overdoses. Add to that number Jimi Hendrix, and up to the present, Amy Winehouse. They form a lineage of artists who behaved as if self-destruction were the goal of their exploration. In the conversation, I referenced Verlaine and Rimbaud as archetypes of such behavior. Gary's response was illuminating. When Verlaine and Rimbaud were young, he said, they were protesting the iron grip that bourgeois rationality had on all aspects of 19th century French culture. The manners, the view of reality, the exclusion of the wild from public life. Rationality in business and society were dominant values. Deranging the senses was one strategy artists like Verlaine and Rimbaud employed to break free of that. Today, he continued, the bourgeoisie is sociopathic, overindulged, distracted, spoiled beyond measure, and unable to restrain itself in gluttony, even in the face of impending planetary destruction. In the face of such a threat, it has by necessity become the responsibility of the artist to model health and sanity. Oh, Peter says. Now, you hear in that idealization of Verlaine and Rimbaud, and this idea of the derangement of the senses, another version of this need to smash the ego, as if basically our problem is that we are constrained, uptight, unable to be free, and that the basic role of practice is to smash the bars of our conceptual jail cell. And as Snyder indicates, there may be some cultures and some circumstances, and particularly it may be true in Japanese culture that is very hierarchical, very structured, very conformist, that breaking through all of that is a dominant theme. But Snyder's point is that we may find ourselves in a very different situation, that our goal is not one of smashing the self, but maybe of putting together a sane and cohesive and socially responsible self. And what he says about the artist having to become the embodiment of sanity and health, I think is what I've tried to convey when I say a Zen student has to make their bed. Right? It's the constructive side of what this practice is about. We're not about derangement, we're also about care and attention and being meticulous and conserving what we have. So we have to, in both of these cases, watch whether we've gotten ourselves into the grip of a particular metaphor, whether it's this metaphor of purity or clarity and endlessly trying to wipe away contaminants. You know, so often practice comes down to It was a good sitting. My mind was very calm and clear, right? Well, no, that was just a calm and clear sitting. You know, a good sitting is when you develop the correct perspective on your thoughts and feelings and emotion and pain. Not when you suddenly, you know, have a little interlude of being relieved of all those things. Dogen finally ends this teisho with the story of Nangaku and Basa, which I'm sure is very familiar, but I'll just read quickly his version of it. One day Nangaku visited Basa's hut and asked, "What have you been doing recently?" Basa replied, "I've been doing nothing but sit in zazen." Then Nangaku asked, "Why do you continually sit in zazen?" Basa answered, "I sit in zazen in order to become Buddha." Then Nangaku picked up a tile and started to polish it using a tile he found by the side of Basa's hut. Basa watched what he was doing and asked, "Master, what are you doing?" Nangaku answered, "I'm polishing this tile." "Why are you polishing the tile?" "To make a mirror." "How can you make a mirror by polishing a tile?" Nangaku replied, "How can you become a Buddha by doing zazen?" Now Dogen has a interesting take on that. He's not simply saying that it's a mistake to use your zazen in order to become something. See, that kind of instrumental error is one that we understand that. We could say it's endlessly pursuing something that's out on the horizon. There's this thing, becoming a Buddha, becoming enlightened. You think someone else has it. It's out there. I'm going to get it. This is what Hegel called unhappy consciousness, the projection of an ideal state off on the horizon, or into a master, the projection sort of guaranteeing that it's always outside and never in you. And the more you pursue it, the more you just affirm that you don't have it already. If you keep digging yourself deeper into the assumption that it's something you lack. Now Dogen's alternative to this is as follows. People nowadays should pick up tiles and polish them in order to make the mirror. If the tile does not become the mirror, people will not become Buddha. If they frivolously think that a tile is basically a clod of earth, then they too are basically clods of earth. If a human being has mind, then a tile also has mind. Who else knows when a tile appears, there is a mirror to reflect it? And then when a mirror appears, there is a mirror to reflect it. Basically, he's saying that we must understand the zazen, the polishing of the tile, as being Buddha, not becoming Buddha. We must understand that when the polished tile is the mirror, Basho is Buddha. When Basho is Buddha, Basho directly becomes Basho. When Basho is Basho, his zazen directly becomes zazen. So polishing the tile to make the mirror is the essence of the Buddhas and patriarchs. Accordingly, the tile becomes the ancient mirror. And when we polish the mirror, we will find untainted and pure practice. So he takes this story of Basho and Nangaku, in a way turns it on his head, saying that our daily zazen is the actualization of what we see in that ancient mirror. That if who we are is most basically our Buddha nature, that is manifested in our sitting. Now, Dogen's perspective is that Zazen is to being human, sort of like what swimming is to a fish and flying is to a bird. It's sort of its most natural expression. If you most deeply realize who and what you are, it will spontaneously kind of manifest in this life of Zazen and being a monk. Now, as lay people, householder Zen, we want to expand upon that. And I think that many of you have realized your true nature, not just as expressed in Zazen, but expressed in service. We can say that that's another natural outflowing of our understanding, that it leads to compassion and service and functioning in the world. But Dogen is in the grip of a mystical vision of monasticism, and realization is expressed perfectly in the monk's life and in the practice of Zazen. When newcomers come to the Zendo, and I offer them some beginning instruction, I typically say, sit down facing the wall as if you're facing a mirror. The mirror does all the work. Your face automatically appears. You can't do it right or wrong. What do you see?